This podcast sponsored by Cherry Hill Volvo.
At Cherry Hill Volvo, we have absolutely incredible offers, and a plethora of both new and certified Volvos from which to choose. Join Cherry Hill Volvo for the pricing and attention you deserve. I am Judith Krupnik, president of Cherry Hill Volvo.
The Rich Cioli Show Podcast.
Early on the morning of 3rd October, as I mentioned, U.S. forces accompanied that Nigerian unit on a reconnaissance mission to gather information. The assessment by our leaders on the ground at that time was that contact with the enemy was unlikely. Mid-morning on October 4th, the patrol began to take fire as they were returning to their operating base. Approximately 1 hour after taking fire, the team requested support. And within minutes, a remotely piloted aircraft arrived overhead. Within an hour, French Mirage jets arrived on station. And then later that afternoon, French attack helicopters arrived on station, and a Nigerian quick reaction force arrived in the area where our troops were in contact with the enemy. During a firefight, two U.S. soldiers were wounded and evacuated by French air to Niamey, and that was consistent with the casualty evacuation plan that was in place for this particular operation. Three U.S. soldiers who were killed in action were evacuated on the evening of 4 October, and at that time, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson was still missing. On the evening of 6 October, Sergeant Johnson's body was found and subsequently evacuated. From the time the firefight was initiated until Sergeant Johnson's body was recovered, French, Nigerian, or U.S. forces remained in that area. Now, many of you have asked a number of questions, and those are all, and many of them are fair questions, and we owe you more information. More importantly, we owe the families that have fallen more information, and that's what the investigation is designed to identify.
All right, that's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at a press conference that is actually still in process right now at the Pentagon, essentially saying now we have over 800 troops in the region, in the area, and that is because of the gathering storm of ISIS. I haven't, and I don't think anybody has had a chance to really process all this yet. He said today, our assessment right now is that it is an ISIS-affiliated group regarding the ambush assault. And he also says now that there are 800 U.S. troops currently in Niger and more troops there than any other African nation. The area is inherently dangerous and that it is becoming an ISIS stronghold, which is why they are there. Quote, the reason why we're in West Africa is because it's an area of concentration of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, he says. Look, we're all just kind of learning all this. I mean, even literally Lindsey Graham didn't even know there were troops in the area. So this is going to be one of those points of discussion of whether or not we should still be there, whether or not we should put more troops there. I imagine all these conversations are going to take place in the next few days. But Rand Paul hit Lindsey Graham pretty good today when he said, you know, when even a warmonger like Lindsey Graham doesn't know where we have troops throughout the world, then you know that we're in a lot of places around the world. So I imagine there's going to be some debate about this and then what the operation is going to look like henceforth. Oh, do we have enough? Because if you're going to be in a place, you obviously want to make sure you have enough to be able to, you know, win. Otherwise, the question then becomes, why are we there? So these questions are going to be debated in the next few days. It's interesting, though, how some in the U.S. Senate didn't even know we had a U.S. presence there. Like I said, this is all literally happening right now, so I'll have more analysis for you on this tomorrow. But I did want to share with you that the press conference by General Joseph Dunford is still taking place, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and obviously we lost four service members in this ambush, and it's a very, very sad thing for our nation without question. And that the general acknowledging we owe the families a lot of information, and still this ambush and why this ambush occurred and was this an intelligence failure and how could it have been prevented and that sort of thing. These are all questions that are going to need to be answered without a doubt. All right, 855-839-1210, #1210 on a cell, and cbsphilly.com/rich. I'll get back to the Hollywood stuff in a minute, but one of the things, again, that I keep referencing is this notion, and I think I have for a while now, that you can dislike a lot of things about Donald Trump if you are not a Trump fan, but the one thing that I think needs to stop is this notion that he's a fascist or a totalitarian dictator. In other words, you can dislike his tweets. Fair game. That's a legitimate point of contention. Maria Bartiromo asked the president about that. I'll play you that audio in a minute, but you can not like his stance on NAFTA. In other words, what you can't do, though, is make things up. That bugs me. It really bugs me when people just make things up. And this notion that he's this totalitarian fascist dictator. David Harsanyi, who's a writer over at Reason.com and also National Review, he's got a piece here. Trump's executive moves have strengthened checks and balances. And I should point out, Harsanyi is not a big Trump guy, never was, and is not now. He writes, say what you will about Donald Trump, and there's plenty to say, but he might be the first president in memory to actively limit his own branch's power. Whatever his intentions on immigration, funding issues, international agreements, and the regulatory state, Trump has relinquished executive power. When President Barack Obama was governing through executive fiat for more than 6 years, there was precious little anxiety from our elite news publications regarding precedents of abuse or constitutional overreach. Whenever people criticized Obama's overreach, the reaction was to demand that we tally up the number of executive orders signed by the Republican presidents who were there before him. It was then, as it is now, an exceptionally silly or perhaps just exceptionally dishonest way to contrast presidential records. I'm glad Sandy points this out, because one of the things that bugs me is when people call up and they go, well, you were decrying all these executive orders and now you have all these executive orders. And when are you going to say something about it? And I have been pretty consistent on this. When they exceed executive authority, I certainly will. Like, you know how I feel about the whole civil forfeiture thing, right? That exceeds constitutional authority and needs to be stopped ASAP. I don't care how good people think it is for this cause or that cause or fighting the war on drugs or whatever. In my opinion, it is completely unconstitutional and has to stop. So, yes, when there are things that exceed the authority of the Constitution, he didn't create it, by the way. He's just not stopping it. But when there are things that exceed the Constitution or the authority of the executive, I will certainly say it, as I have been saying so. But the idea that you count the number of executive orders and you go, well, the point is this. Most of Trump's executive orders up to this point have been statements of intent, administrative moves, or reviews of Obama-era orders. Moreover, there's nothing improper about executive orders or actions that are derived from the Constitution or meant to implement law. Trump's order on promoting free speech and religious freedom, for example, didn't go nearly far enough, in his opinion. In the writer's opinion. But there's plenty wrong with executive orders and actions meant to circumvent those things. Not only did the last administration habitually craft what was in essence sweeping legislation from the ether of the Oval Office, but it also often framed these abuses as good governance. Congress won't act. We have to do something was a central argument of Obama's second term. Every issue was a moral imperative worthy of the president's pen. Relitigating the past is often a waste of time, but fixing it is less so. There might be wide-ranging support for DACA, for example, but it was an obvious way to bypass process. Even President Obama, perhaps fearing legal challenges, called DACA a temporary stopgap when he first announced it, although now I think everybody turns around and goes, oh, it's got to stay here forever. You might have been a fan of the Paris Climate Accord, the writer points out, but let's not forget here that this was also a treaty that they did a backdoor stop on, so there would have to be no advice and consent as per the Constitution. When Democrats couldn't pass their carbon cap and trade plan, the Obama administration instituted a power plan that outstripped the legal authority Congress had afforded the EPA. Ultimately, that would be challenging court down the road. And rightfully so, the court said that they had exceeded their authority. He writes here, perhaps this kind of regulatory and executive teeter-tottering is what we can expect in an increasingly divided nation. With organic division comes gridlock, and with gridlock comes an enticement to act outside the process. So one hopes that Trump's nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch and judges elsewhere who take both separation of powers and the dangers of the administrative state seriously will help mitigate some of these future abuse. Who knows? Perhaps many of these changes will be even more important than Trump's ugly tweets. For those who argue that all of this is nothing more than a effort to sabotage the Obama administration's accomplishments, perhaps there's a lesson to be learned. Your legacy is going to be a rickety mess if you build it using imperious diktats rather than consensus. And that's a good point here. From, again, I always try to find people that are not huge Trump, you know, pom-pom people. When they write things like this, you know that you can take it pretty seriously. So when Harsanyi writes this, and they write this over at Reason, calling him the great deregulator-in-chief, there's something to this. And I think that, again, to go back to my earlier point, which is some point I've been repeating throughout the course of the afternoon, you can have a lot of disagreements. You can criticize this or criticize that. That's normal. It's healthy. That's part of our democratic process. And I hope you know, you wouldn't just turn a blind eye to the things that you disagree with in the past. However, when the left and the media start calling or giving a platform to people that call them a fascist, a dictator, a totalitarian, as Aaron Burnett alluded to the other night, that's shameful because it's not happening. The evidence is not there. The evidence, in fact, on the opposite, is that his executive moves have given Congress more authority, and he has, in fact, retreated from this stance of executive authority. Now, we got a long way to go because it's not, he's not the first and he won't be the last. This, the power of the presidency has gotten way too powerful, way too big. The founders would cringe. There's a reason why Article 1 is Congress and Article 2 is the president, because the founders wanted Congress to be the most important branch of our three branches of government. And the presidency has gotten way too big and way too powerful. But as Harsanyi writes, again, not a huge Trump guy, but calls it like he sees it, as he points out here, Trump has relinquished executive power. He might be the first president in memory to actively limit his own branch's power. So that, I'd say, is a pretty good response to any of your friends who turn around and try to tell you that we are careening towards fascism.
Rizzioli 3 to 6, Talk Radio 1210, WPHD. Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.